Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the Inside Story. This episode, I met with Mike McPhee, co-chair and founding partner of Falkirk Environmental. Mike and I discuss what he's learned from both his successes and failures in his more than 20 years in the industry, as well as the importance of community support. Without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Mike McPhee. Our guest today is Mike McPhee. Mike has been working in the natural resource sector for over 25 years. Mike is a specialist in regulatory affairs, project permitting, Indigenous engagement, public policy, and sustainability associated with major resource projects. Mike was also the founding president and CEO of Curis Resources, that he grew to a value of over $200 million before a friendly takeover by Taseko Mines in 2014. He is also the executive chairman of IDM Mining until its takeover by Ascot Resources in 2019. Mike is currently the co-chair and founding partner of Falkirk Environmental. He serves as vice president, sustainability and external affairs with Talisker Resource, and is on the board of advisors of Resolve, a U.S.-based non-governmental organization focused on sustainability. Mike, welcome to the show.
Yeah, that's great to be here. Thanks, Chad.
So, Mike, we kind of met very randomly through the social media channels where one of your posts caught my eye. About a mining project that you had worked on, and here we are. So
yeah,
kind of serendipitous introduction. Why don't we start with a bit about your background? Tell us your background, how you ended up in this natural resource sector.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, pleasure talking to you. And you know, I like a lot of young folks, I think you get that first job out of university, and it can kind of lead you down a path if you're lucky. I did an undergraduate degree in physical geography. I was kind of focused on how landscapes get formed and glaciers and all that kind of good stuff. And I ended up working up in the Arctic looking for diamonds. And back in the early mid 1990s, you know, Canada, it was known that Canada had diamonds as part of our geological kind of makeup, but we didn't really know what the extent of it was. And there was a big find there by two gentlemen who've gone on to become billionaires by the name of Chuck Fipke and Stu Blessum. And they founded the Ekati Diamond Mine, which I believe it's still operating today, you know, like 20 plus years later. And it really sparked this rush of exploration, and the whole north was covered with mineral claims and hundreds of young folks out there looking for the next big find. And I got drawn into that, and it was exciting. It was, you know, you were seeing junior mining stock prices go from 20 cents to $3 in a matter of weeks. You just had this mass rush of people up there looking, and it was like a modern day kind of gold rush. And that was pretty exciting for me as a young guy going into that. And I did all sorts of different aspects, from soil sampling to permitting, to working with Indigenous communities, to, you know, geophysics, to whatever else. And have lots of stories out of that time. But it really introduced me to the kind of the ideas around resources and just the landscape of Canada. I mean, it's an extraordinary part of the world. And after that, I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to make a career out of this space, working in mineral resources and related, I better understand it. And so I applied and took a job in Northern Ontario called a place called Timmins, which is a historic gold mining town, and spent 5 or 6 years there, and eventually, you know, did everything from underground mining to tailings dam management to all the rest of it. And through that, I got drawn into a group within the company called a project development group, where we we began to conceptualize new opportunities. And this is where you start taking projects through permitting and environmental assessments and working with communities and doing all the feasibility analysis and framing it out. And I was a young guy going in, and I really found my calling in that space, which is the, and it's in that, you know, from discovery through to production space, which I have worked in for the rest of my career. And it really, it started with diamonds and then, you know, really got a boost once I started working in a gold mining town of Timmins, which, of course, that's where Shania Twain is from, you know, for anybody who remembers Shania. That's her tone. And I will tell you, I did meet her. She came to town. She did this home tour and it was publicized all over. That was right at the height of her stardom, and she showed up, and that was my big brush with celebrity when I was in Timmins, Ontario.
I forgot about that, actually.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
That was really my introduction to it, and it's gone on to become a fantastic career that I've worked in that space, and have never strayed far from it since. So
How early on did you start to get exposure to the access piece, permitting? How early on did you start to get a flavor for that?
Yeah, it was probably, you know, it probably was in Timmins. And there was a project I was working on, which was a collaboration between a former major Canadian mining company called Placer Dome, which was purchased by what is now the largest gold mining company in the world called Barrick back in the late 1990s, and a local company out of Vancouver called Royal Oak Mines. And it was an expansion project where we had to actually reroute a highway, put a causeway over a lake, and a whole bunch of stuff associated with that. And it was called the Pamour Expansion Project. And that was where I really got introduced to the whole issue of Indigenous engagement, of working with local municipal councils, with community concerns, you know, and working with all levels of government, because it involved federal fisheries and everything else associated with a major infrastructure project like that would involve the relocation of a highway and everything. And so it was really there that became a big focus of my work and interest from that point on. Yeah. So it was back probably 1996, 97 that was going on. And yeah, I really saw the intersection of all those interests in one major project.
Yeah. That would be a wide variety of different stakeholders, interested parties that you're dealing with a project like that. When you started to lean into that, were there any surprises that stand out?
Well, you know, access is an interesting thing, right? When you look at it as the definition of access, you know, you're basically being given permission for entry or development or whatever. And you know, if you look at the mineral exploration business, which is not too dissimilar from other extractive, whether it's gas or oil, or whatever, you begin with, you know, your mineral tenure, which you apply for and you pay for and all the rest, and it's held within your company. And you begin that stage of exploration where, at least in the mineral side, you start out with soil sampling, do all these surveys, you show that there's minerals there, and then you might do some drilling and then prove up that you have a resource. And you go through a whole series of steps that might take quite a long time, right? It all depends how the results, and sometimes guys get lucky and find something big right away. Sometimes it takes years and years, whatever it might be. But you then move from that sort of discovery phase into, say, okay, we have something here that might be economic, so we're going to begin to wrap a project around it and say, you know, we're going to develop a mine or a quarry or whatever it might be. You know, that you move into that phase of trying to decide, okay, well, what is this thing? And then you have to begin to conceptualize that in the broader world. And it's like any development. I mean, Canada is a big place, but there's people everywhere, right? I mean, whether it's Indigenous people or purple people in rural communities, and they have different experiences with industrial development. And it's really that access point. Like, you can have legal access, but I think what we've learned, particularly probably in the last 20 years, is that the other side of access is having community support for what you're doing. Because what I've learned over time, I think, has been that, you know, particularly in more recent time, I think, is government, you know, yeah, you can be issued a license to do something, but if you don't have, it isn't that everybody's going to agree, but if you don't have a sort of a consensus level of support, that access, legal access, doesn't really mean much if you can't get people on side, as we've particularly seen. And I think that work of community involvement, it's always been there, but I think in the last 20 years, it's really increased. And I began to see that in Timmins for sure, because there was concerns. I mean, when you're talking about rerouting a highway and everything, people are going to have a voice on that. It's a mining town, so access was never really too big a deal in Timmins, because they kind of know where the wealth comes from, and so generally really supportive, although there's oversight. But I've learned that, I guess, is that access I define in two ways. One's there's legal access, but and rights to develop, but then there's that whole community side of access, which I think is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's it's a good segue into my next question for you around philosophy. And it sounds like, and probably most of us that have gotten into this world of access have developed an appreciation, hopefully by now anyway, for that need for that buy-in. I suppose it's like, you know, the analogy or the comparison would be to leadership. You know, the title doesn't make you a leader. You know, it's your behavior. And I think it's kind of a similar notion.
Yeah.
The philosophies, what point did you start to develop your own philosophies around, like, what works, what doesn't work when it comes to getting buy-in, I think, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting thing, right? Because, and it is, every community is different, of course. And what I think what I've learned is, particularly in the resource space, we're pretty good at telling stories and conceptualizing ideas. We're kind of problem solvers by our very nature. You know, we look for opportunities, and people are really proud of the work they do. And there's a lot of fantastic people in our space, on the industry side, that are, I think, legitimately trying to create economic opportunity for locally, and, you know, and support the whole national kind of agenda of creating a better place, right? And opportunities for young people and contributing and all that, paying taxes and all that kind of stuff. The challenge when you come to things about the use of the land, and whether it's digging a hole in the ground or putting a well down or whatever it is that I don't know if we're very good at listening and giving time for those conversations. Like, you know, one of the examples I've used sometimes when I'm talking with other leaders in the business about, of course, work with First Nations or Indigenous people is a big part of doing anything in Canada. And you know, sometimes it's that whole concepts of time, right? Like our typical way in the Western world is to book a meeting from 11 to 12 and you come in, you sit down, you talk about it, and you move on, right? Well, anybody who's worked in this space, you might spend, say it's a 3-hour meeting, you might spend the first 2 hours just talking about the past, right? You may not even get to the thing that you thought you were coming in to talk about. And it may take 2 or 3 meetings to get to the point where you're actually going to talk. But in other communities, they want to know who you are. They want to know if you're full of shit, excuse my language, or if you're a good person, and that you're going to follow through on what you say you're going to do. And I often find in our business, I apologize, we're driven pretty fast. And I think with communities, you got to sit down and take the time to understand what the real issues are. That, you know, if the concern is over noise, like from a project or dust or who knows what it might be. It might be that, or it might be just the fact that where you're working is changing and you're causing that change. And some people may not want that change, right? So you gotta, and I think that's one of the, probably the biggest, one of the biggest things I've learned is that when you're dealing with big developments and things like that, in particular in access, you got to kind of sit down and understand people's stories and why, where their concerns might come from, and try and get out in front of that and see what you can do to address it. It isn't always an engineering solution, and sometimes it might be, but really for me, that's probably one of the biggest things is you got to take the time, and it's got to be sincere, and you got to take the time to understand what people are worried about. And if you do that and you show empathy and understanding, you have a much better chance at being successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a, the importance of being relational in the work that we do, you know, versus being right about what we do is just, I think maybe understated. It's so important. How do you balance on some of these projects? Like, you know, the image I have of a successful mining project, you know, is a large disturbance. So they can be a large physical disturbance.
They can.
Like, how do you balance that relational aspect, the stakeholder relationship, their interests, their concerns, with, you know, the needs of the board of directors or the, you know, at the end of the day, moving something forward? And you know, the economic balance with the relational piece. What's your view on that? How do you approach?
Yeah, it's I mean, you're right, because it's easy to talk about, you know, taking time and everything, but when you've got shareholders and you've got boards and you're being driven, because, you know, at the end of the day, the company's in business to generate value, right? And there is a tension there. There's no doubt, but I think what is key is, you know, if you push too hard and you don't allow those conversations to take place, then and you lose that license to whether you refer to it as a social license or community support, whatever the terminology you want to use, if you lose that, then the project's not going to be worth anything, you know? So like, it's kind of, because there are examples in the country, not in Canada and BC and other places in the world where projects don't go ahead when you have community opposition. Right. And so I think it's, in some respects, it's a risk management strategy, and there's a lot of, you gotta be really smart about it, and you gotta be able to separate out what's a substantive issue and what's just kind of noise in the background and all that kind of stuff, right? So it's really important that the people that are working on it are smart and understanding of, but I'll give you just a quick example, Chad. Like, when I've worked a lot internationally, and I remember I was doing a project down in Southern Argentina. We had a gold project down there that we acquired. It was a big discovery. It was a really, really important development. It was right at the very, very southern tip of Argentina. So like South America is just across the water, a little town called Puerto Deseado. And there was a military base there and everything. And it was a very prolific gold area. And so we had this fantastic project. And what we did really thoughtfully, and I support the board in this, is we did this really deep dive to understand every aspect of relationships in the area, their history. The Catholic Church was a big player in that area. The schools, who are the leaders in the community, understanding all these relationships. And we probably spent 3 months just kind of dissecting the whole understanding of the area. And then we made sure that we talked with people along the way, and we built relationships with all the key influencers in the community. And it was not manipulative in any way. It was just we took the time. We hired an anthropologist. We needed to know the history of everybody. And then we targeted our conversations so that we made the best use of our time. And that project went ahead without any controversy at all. In an area that would be considered, you know, economic, environmentally sensitive. you compare that sometimes to our, and maybe it's because we're local or whatever, but sometimes in Canada or other North American areas, we can kind of take some of that for granted. We don't take the time to really understand, because we think we know because we're from here, right? Like, but you really do have to sit down and understand people, and you got to understand the communities, and you got to understand where their concerns are. I'll give you another, just a really quick example. I was working on a project in northwestern Ontario. There's a beautiful river there called the English Wabagon River system that runs down from northern Manitoba through into Ontario. And there was this rare metals project there. And we thought it was great. It was going to be, you know, you're providing critical minerals, all this kind of stuff. This is a few years ago. And we went to see one of the nations there, First Nations there, to talk about it. And we're like, you know, this is going to be a great project, jobs, you know, opportunity. We'd like to work with you, this sort of thing. And we didn't get a great reception. And I realized afterwards, one of the reasons we didn't, you know, and there's a whole story there. But at the end of the day, what happened was about 20 or 25 years earlier, there was a company out of the United Kingdom who had come there and built a pulp and paper mill that over a 10-year period dumped like 9,000 pounds of methyl mercury into the river system. And now those communities had like 90% rates of poisoning from mercury in their bloodstream, like they were found. And the legacy of that continues on to this day. And like that had nothing to do with us, of course, but when people have had that kind of an experience with an industrial developer, that I'm sure there were engineers there saying, oh, everything will be fine, you can understand why they would be concerned, right, of any other development along the banks of their river. And I use that example only because I think that sitting down, like, it wasn't that they were opposed to development. It was that they really needed a level of assurance that the same kind of thing wasn't going to happen. And us just saying it wasn't going to happen wasn't enough, right? Like, they need to be involved in it. And I think that's, over my career, I've begun to realize there are stories like that, you know, where history kind of repeats itself and people get worried, and and that affects people's perception of what it is that we're proposing to do. So there's a lot in there that you can think about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a great example.
Yeah.
We have this saying sort of developed by accident, I mean, go slow to go fast. And what I'm hearing you describe and share with that experience is that front end patience of understanding who you're dealing with and the history. We probably do take it for granted a bit too much in our own backyard, because we assume too much.
Yeah.
And that's a good lesson for, you know, our listeners to consider. Let's talk about some of the projects you've worked on. You know, like I mentioned earlier, that these mining projects can have quite a large footprint once they go to full development. And you've mentioned to me earlier in our discussions how there are some nuances just in even getting to a point where you have something to develop. It can't necessarily be done always with a minimal impact at that stage even.
Yeah.
But tell us about some of the cool projects you've been involved in.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, anybody who's considering a career, it can be a pretty fun business. I've had a chance to work in so many different countries and had some really interesting stories. And when, I mean, this, you know, look, we can all look at the population growth projected in the world. I think we're supposed to get to like 9 billion people in the next 30, I don't know how long, next 50 years or whatever it is. And my point in saying that is this interface between extractivist projects and communities and populations is only going to become more pronounced, right? And like, for example, you know, there's a big push in renewable energy these days, or electric cars or whatever it might be. And, you know, the statistics are pretty clear that the amount of minerals, whether it's copper or nickel or cobalt or whatever it might be, that are going to be used in this shift that's taking place now, like it's happening today, is pretty dramatic. And so there's going to be a real pressure on the development of these new projects. And there are going to be concerns, I'm sure. And so we do need to approach them really carefully. You know, one example, which is how you and I'm going to give you sort of what I think are kind of three examples of one that went really well, one that took a long time to figure out, and then the third one, which was a bit of a disaster. And the two of them I was involved in, I can say the disaster one I wasn't, but I've observed what happened there. But, you know, I maybe start with the one in the middle, which is this Arizona project that you and I met over. This project was a fascinating copper project because it actually was the technology that was being employed. It's in central Arizona near a town called Florence, in between Tucson and Phoenix, you know, out in the desert, basically. The town of Florence is a great little place that a number of people live in. Its main economy is our prisons. There's actually 10 federal and state prisons there. And I think of the 26,000 people that are on the registry as residents, like 18,000 of them are inmates. So gives you a little bit of a
okay.
I took my kids down there once, and I drove them around the perimeter with the guys in the orange suits walking around in circles, saying, you know, if you ever screw up, this is what happens to you. put a little fear into them, because these some of the hardened folks behind those fences looked pretty scary. But anyway, we on the outskirts of that community, we had a copper project. It was something that was discovered actually a while ago, and it was developed partially by BHP, which is one of the largest, you know, commodities companies in the world. The company we were in called Curis, we bought the property, and then I was the CEO of it. We took the company public, raised a bunch of money, and began to move it through the engineering and permitting process. In this case, you know, access is interesting because we had the land tenure, we owned the private land, we had everything, but it just so happened that the property next to us was purchased by a large land developer out of San Diego. And we ended up in this situation where they bought theirs after we were starting development of ours, but they kind of took the position that they didn't know a mining project was going to go forward. And we ended up in quite a battle, a legal battle. They had a very large land position. They sold an idea of this retirement community that they're going to build thousands of homes and everything, and that it was incompatible with what we were proposing. Now, the type of mining that we were proposing to do is something, not to get too technical, but it's something called in situ mining, where you basically pump this solution into the ground, it dissolves the copper, we bring it back up, and then we turn it into these copper sheets. So the only thing you actually see on the surface are these steel pumps that sit about 3 feet above the ground, 3 to 5 feet above the ground. And there would be about 200 of them over a field. And, but that's about the extent of the, you wouldn't see a big hole in a big open pit or anything, the things that you referred to. So we thought it was pretty cool and very compatible. We could show that it wouldn't affect water or supplies or quality or anything. And you have to go through an extensive permitting process with the Department of Environmental Quality in Arizona and the Environmental Protection Agency. And, you know, so there's a lot of oversight. But we ended up in this very tough battle with this land developer. And they had a very strong influence on the local politics and the town council and the mayor and things like that. And it turned into, unfortunately, the town took the position in alignment with the land developer to challenge all our approvals. So we ended up in a very expensive, long litigation and all the rest, right? So it was as a Canadian, it was my first introduction into the U.S. legal system, which I have learned is a little more aggressive than what we're used to up here. So long story short, we went all the way through it, and the company went public in 2011. We were then taken over at the end of 2014. I was the CEO at the time and did all the initial stuff, took it up to a level, was part of those early debates and the legal fights and all the rest. But then our company was taken over. We started to get into some financial pressure because of these legal constraints. And so another company, a Canadian company called Taseco, took us over. They had a little bigger war chest, and they had a couple operating mines here in British Columbia. And so they were able to sustain that fight over a longer period of time. So fast forward to a couple of weeks ago, and the Supreme Court in Arizona finally made a decision, the final decision in this after multiple appeals and everything. And the town of Florence finally dropped their opposition, and now the town council is fully in support. And Taseco, now the owner of Curis, got paid back the almost $3 million in legal fees that they had to spend in defending it over almost a 10-year period. Mm-hmm. And now the project has its permits and it's moving ahead, right? So that took like 10 or 11 years. And the interesting thing about that is that we had a really strong constituency of support there within the community. But when you had another vested interest with their own reasons to oppose us, it really started to create elements of division and uncertainty. There were the science start getting skewed, and people would put out stuff that was very emotional. And it became this, you know, quite a legal saga. There were big town meetings of hundreds of people, and, you know, it was quite, and I have to say, as being, we were a publicly traded company. And when you get into that environment, it was really hard. I mean, I have to be honest, I learned a lot, but standing up in front of a town planning department and in this fight that was then reported in the newspaper, which then was affecting our share price and everything, it was pretty stressful stuff. Right. And I look back on it now and I say to myself, well, what are the lessons that you learn? One is, I don't think, in fairness to us, these guys came in later and bought the land and had their own ideas. So I don't, even early engagement, or I don't think we could have done much to prepare ourselves for that. But, you know, you also so maybe there isn't anything we could have done, and we should just, all you had to do is stick to the guns. But the reality is that when you're in that kind of a situation, when two businesses are fighting over something like land, they were a lot bigger than us. So it was really hard. And I think maybe we should have sat down with them a little more at the beginning and said, because it wasn't good for them either. It stalled their development for years and everything. And maybe in retrospect, if we had sat down with the CEO of that land development company rather than fighting them and said, okay, look, guys, we both have a vested interest here in trying to make this work, would we have been able to get there? I don't know. But 10 years of litigation, I don't think was good for anybody. And regardless of the fact that ultimately they won, there was a lot of value that was lost along the way. So it was, right. So anyway, it's an interesting story, and one that around Arizona circles is known pretty well and is a bit of history around there.
Really interesting. Well, and it kind of, hearing that reminds me a little bit of some of the one in particular, through BC, a pipeline project that has had a lot of opposition from government and municipalities, not triggered by a land developer, but I'd say triggered by people with other interests, which has made the narrative hard to keep consistent, I would say, for that project. It sounds similar. So that's a good example of a.
Yeah. And I think it also shows that, you know, if you get an approval from the federal government, or you get an approval from the state or whatever, or the province, if the community isn't on side, that approval doesn't mean that much. You know, like it can, you can still get hung up for a long time. We don't live in as litigious a kind of society here in Canada, where you don't often get these big legal challenges to permits. But down in the US, it's very normal. You'll get a permit issued and somebody will challenge it. And you got to kind of add in on another 6 months to a year to defend yourself. And that you almost have to build that into the permitting process because it's part of the nature down there. And you just need to understand it. But as a Canadian company working in a foreign jurisdiction, which they're our close friends, of course, the US, but it is a different environment. And it's something you really have to be aware of because that is a reality. And just to give you another example that was really, really positive for us was an underground gold mining project up in northwestern British Columbia that was called Red Mountain. And this is underground. And the thing about underground is the surface expression of the mining is quite a bit less because it's all underground tunnels and stuff. In this case, the interesting thing is that the main group there is a First Nation called the Nishka. The Nishka were one of the first treaty nations in British Columbia. There was a gentleman by the name of Joe Gosnell, who's a doctor who really led through that process and was a really celebrated leader. And so they signed a treaty back in the 1990s. Anyway, the thing about that project was where we began our relationship with them from the day we bought the project on day one. And that relationship that we built very deeply over time was extraordinary. And it really helped open the way to that project going forward. We went through a full provincial federal environmental assessment, took 2 or 3 years, but we came out of that with a stamp of approval from everyone and very little opposition, if any. And really it began with building that relationship right from the beginning. And it was a pretty deep relationship that we really lived through. And I'll tell you one little story that might be interested to the folks that are listening is one of the things I learned in that was the power of social media. We had, and very uncontrolled on the company side, we had quite a few employees that were Nishka members, you know, and the project itself is up at about 5,000 feet. It's surrounded by glaciers. It's an extraordinarily beautiful part of the country. And so it's very picturesque and it leads to photos being taken by everybody who goes up there. Well, about a third of our workforce leading up to almost half was Indigenous. And the interesting thing was there's a strong use of Facebook and things like that in those communities. And what was fascinating was these young men and women who were working for us had a lot of success. They would post pictures of themselves working and talk about how happy they were being up there and like, look, another day at Red Mountain working, doing this kind of stuff. And that stuff would then be seen by their elders and the communities and everything, totally unscripted on our part. And if we were running a shoddy operation and health and safety was a problem and things like that, you know, that would have shown up, right? But what they were really proud. And I'll tell you, the power of the folks in the community seeing their young people working and the pride in their face of having a job and doing all this stuff and providing for their own families. What we found was of anything we did, it was like, and we didn't even do it. It was just, we created the environment for that to happen, but it was really interesting. And it relates to access. Cause when we would go to those communities and say, okay, we want to build this big mine and roads and, you know, power lines and all this kind of stuff, we would go in there. What they saw were images of their young people working at our project and really enjoying themselves. So those conversations were really easy. They were like, because they knew we were good guys, we were doing good things, mm-hmm. and it showed. And it was kind of fascinating to me because as much as we all try and promote what we're doing, often it can seem like corporate propaganda and stuff, right? When you're trying to like, but when you actually have the workers going out there and telling their story, it really opened the door to us. And it was just kind of one of those things that I learned to recognize afterwards that it was a pretty big deal and it really mattered and it had a profound impact on people's perception of who we were. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, it is. Well, the support from, like, if it's somebody else promoting it, somebody else pointing out. And they're really, I think what maybe what that does is it brings to light what the economic impacts are really are on a project like that.
Yeah.
And people are happy when they're productive. And
well, and it makes it really hard for, like, and I guess this is part of my main point in this conversation is that I fundamentally believe most of the resource sector are good operators. We're proud of what we do. We work hard. There's examples of folks not doing well. And unfortunately in any business, that's going to happen. Right. But people play into these stereotypes sometimes, and, you know, no amount of sort of information, it's really hard to counter those emotional arguments sometimes, but we're not great at allowing people in to see what we actually do, you know, mm-hmm. And because there tends to be a fence around it, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and that, I think part of the extractives business, mining, energy, whatever, we need to be a lot more transparent and open to what we do. And allow people in to see it, because that example with the Nishka and the young people posting completely unscripted, it was an ability for people that aren't there to see what do people do all day. Because it's, you know, most of it's really, there's a lot of really cool stuff that goes on, right? And unless you're in that space, you don't get a chance to see it. And it's easy to create a narrative that's negative if you don't really know what you're talking about. And I think that's, you know, a pipeline is a really small footprint on the landscape, right? But if you've never been there to see how they're built and the care that they take and everything, it's hard to counter that if you're dealing with people that don't know, you know?
Yeah.
And it's something I've learned over time that we got to mm-hmm. be more open.
I think it's an excellent point. Yeah. Tell us about the third project you had on your mind.
Well, this one is well known. It's called the Ajax Mine in Kamloops, and it was one of those ones that didn't go great because it's a big open pit proposed near a community, and it was an example where, and I think it's one of these things where we have to recognize in the business that, you know, access requires societal support ultimately, like the old days of just out, you know, doing what you want without that support are gone, as we've been talking about. And so in that case, really what happened there is, it's no fault, I'm not trying to assign any blame to anybody, it's just ultimately what happened was the company lost the community along the way, and that project now sits there to this day, and it's not moving forward. It's there's a lot of value there that maybe could have been realized if it was reconsidered, but it was the question of, you know, the level of opposition that was created resulted in the project getting turned down by the governments, and that doesn't happen all that often. People talk about environmental assessments, you know, and things, but it was a clear repudiation of what was being proposed. And there's probably the relationships with indigenous communities weren't great. They lost the narrative with the community, and things have to this point where it may or may not ever even see the light of day. And I think the key there is, but right to the end, they pushed. I don't know what the right answer is, but one of the things I think we have to contend with in our business is that if you get to a point where the level of pushback is so high, sometimes, and I know this is the tension with boards and investors and everything, but at the end of the day, what happened there was they got the ultimate rejection by the government, and the environmental assessment was turned down and everything. I don't know, maybe when you saw it going down that path, and these things are usually not a surprise, they shouldn't be, you should know all the way along where you're kind of at, maybe you should have stepped back, maybe taken the time to reimagine, like, and that, I guess, is one of the things I've seen is that it's a tough thing for industry to accept sometimes, but But I think we have to be prepared to, if we're running against a wall and it's not moving or it's getting stronger and people are pouring more concrete behind it, you know, like you got to recognize when that's happening. And I think, and you got to step back and evaluate, okay, are we on the path we're on? Is this going to work? Is this access ever going to be granted? Or are we going to shut the door to it ever being realized? And I think there's been a few examples like that in the country that have happened where the proponent kept pushing and pushing and pushing and just forced a no. And now you really don't have any value to. And I think we haven't been willing to do that. Like it's sometimes, and I think we have to be open to the fact that you might need to step back sometimes and reevaluate, okay, is this going to work or is this something that we need to rethink? And I think that's a key message. And I think we're going to see more of that going forward is the demand for these minerals. You know, you look at copper prices right now, you know, a year and a half ago, they were about $2 a pound and they're up getting close to $5 now. And that in and of itself is a massive shift. Like, and lumber prices are up and, you know, everything's up, nickel, you know, and all the things that are being used and they're in high demand. But as that demand continues, we're going to need more projects, which are going to bring you up against communities. And, you know, this dynamic is not going away, right? And yeah, it'll probably be even more intense in the years ahead. So mm-hmm. we got to be smarter, right? We got to be smarter about how we approach this stuff. And because if we're not, then we'll just get more no's and the prices will go up because the supply won't be there, which might be good for the guys that are in business. But if you're trying to get something going now, you're going to have a hard time.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to be here. Really interesting to hear about the work you've done and your perspectives and where if people want to reach out to you.
Yeah.
What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think, you know, my, through our company, we have a management group that works with companies on all these issues called Falkirk. And my email address is mike@falkirk.ca. Send me a note if they're interested. Just go to our website and our contact information is there. But yeah, no, I'm more than happy to hear from folks. And I really enjoyed the conversation today. Thanks, Chad.
Well, make sure that we include that email address in the show notes page for this episode. And yeah, it was great, Mike. Thank you.
On. Okay, Chad. All the best.
Thanks so much for listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks' time for another great conversation with industry leaders in the energy and infrastructure space. If you enjoyed the show today, I'd really appreciate it if you subscribed and gave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. This goes a long way in helping other people find the podcast. If you've got questions, comments, or a suggestion for a future guest, please reach out to us at guest@elevated-access.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Chad Hughes. Talk to you next time.